It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Bishop Robert Morlino, who passed away on Saturday, led the Madison Diocese for 15 years. Working in a liberal part of the state, Morlino was known for his conservatism on political and doctrinal issues, including his views of the ongoing child sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church. This hour, we reflect on Morlino's legacy, how he stood in relation to his contemporaries, and what his successor could mean for Catholicism in Wisconsin. Are you Catholic or formerly Catholic? Did you tend to agree or disagree with Bishop Morlino, and why? What are your hopes for the new bishop? Do you hope to see them carry on Bishop Morlino's legacy, or are you looking for change? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Father Stephen Avella is a Catholic priest and professor of history at Marquette University. Welcome back to the Morning Show.
Thank you, John. Nice to be with you.
First of all, tell us a little bit more about who Bishop Robert Morlino was.
Well, he's a son of East Coast Catholicism. He's from Scranton, and he was extremely proud of that. His father died early in his life, and he attended a Jesuit preparatory school in Scranton and then joined the Society of Jesus, the same order that sponsors Marquette University, and was a novice and carried through their formation. He received his undergraduate at Fordham. He got a M.A. in philosophy from the University of Notre Dame, my alma mater, and then he was educated at the Weston School of Theology in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So he had a fairly good academic background, and above all, that interesting Jesuit formation, which places a great emphasis on sharing the faith, explaining the faith, bringing the faith to people on the margins or who are perceived to be on the margins. And he left the Jesuits after his ordination and entered the Diocese of Kalamazoo. How he found common cause with Kalamazoo, I'm not quite sure. But he became a priest there. He was highly esteemed by his bishop and went on for a doctorate in moral theology in Rome at the Gregorian University and rector of the cathedral there in Kalamazoo, and then planned, as from what his official bio says, to be a seminary professor most of his life. He was going to go to the Sacred Heart Seminary in Detroit, which would be, you know, kind of in keeping with someone of his academic pedigree and background. But then he was plucked by Pope John Paul II to become the Bishop of Helena, Montana. Now, that was a time, John Paul was very, very, very particular about who he appointed bishops. And it was a time when they thought they could put Midwestern bishops way out in the West, and it would all just kind of work. But he was there for only a few years, and then in 2003, he relocated to Madison, Wisconsin, where he was until his passing. A kind of a not extraordinary ecclesiastical career. At some point along the line, he must have impressed people in high places that he was capable and competent and could effectively teach the faith and manage, you know, the secular aspects of Episcopal administration.
Morlino served the Madison Diocese for 15 years. How did he shape the diocese? What was his influence?
Well, Madison's a young diocese, relatively speaking. It was only created after World War II. Parts of it had been under the Diocese of La Crosse, under Green Bay, and Milwaukee had been in charge of Madison. And the creation of that diocese was intended to kind of give the local bishop there an opportunity to be a sort of a go-between with state government. Now, I don't know how well that worked, but that Catholic concerns and Catholic interests could be effectively represented by having a bishop, someone of rank there, in the diocese of the capital city of the state. So he was only the fourth bishop of that diocese. The original bishop, William Patrick O'Connor, had been from Milwaukee here. He was a philosophy teacher, Bishop of Superior. Bishop Cletus F. O'Donnell, the second bishop, was really a rather politically astute man. He had been very high up in the ranks of the Archdiocese of Chicago. He'd been an auxiliary bishop and a chancery hand. He certainly represented the church very effectively there. William Bullock, Morlino's immediate predecessor, had come from Des Moines, kind of a lateral move from a Midwestern diocese to another Midwestern diocese. And then Morlino came, and Morlino put his stamp on Madison, I believe in keeping with what Pope John Paul expected of bishops at that time, that they be very firm on certain moral issues, particularly abortion, same-sex marriage, things of that nature, and also that, you know, they be rather orthodox on questions of women's ordination and also somewhat suspicious of the perceived liberalization of the church. Pope John Paul worried about the American church when he became pope. He believed and had heard from many Americans that the church here needed some discipline, some shaping up. And so his task was to replace bishops around the United States. And Morlino, who apparently, because of his Polish background, had some affinity with the Pope, and also because, you know, he was a rather strong person when it came to the kinds of doctrines that John Paul II valued and prioritized, he would be kind of a natural choice. And putting him in a rather famously liberal city like Madison, was, I think, in part intended to kind of accentuate the militance of the church in the wake of what they perceived to be some of the problems with modern society.
So Bishop Morlino was very conservative, and he was placed in a very liberal diocese. And what you're saying is that that was by design?
I would think so, yeah. I would think that you can see this in several other dioceses around the country that had what were considered liberal. And when I use that word liberal, you know, you got to be careful. Those terms are not easily applicable to Catholic bishops. But in cities and communities that had public reputations of being, you know, rather liberal, very, very, very prone or friendly to liberal politics, to liberal politicians, and also perhaps where their own local priests and others were perceived, I'm not saying this was the case, were perceived to be kind of out there, you know, that this place needed some tightening up, it needed some discipline, so on and so forth. And you have a number of these bishops appointed around the country. Robert Morlino would be one of them, perhaps a bit more outspoken, a bit more, you know, in your face about certain things, but he again reflects a trend that Pope John Paul II really started in the 80s and carried on until his death. Pope Benedict continued it to some degree. Pope Francis equally values authenticity, loyalty, a strong Catholic presence. But it's a matter of means and ends, mm-hmm. matter of means. How do you do this? Francis takes a different set of means to proclaim basically the same kinds of Catholic truths and Catholic identity issues that Morlino did.
Father Stephen Avella is a Catholic priest and professor of history at Marquette University. We're talking about the passing of Bishop Morlino and wondering what your thoughts are. If you're a Catholic or formerly a Catholic, did you tend to agree with Bishop Morlino? Why or why not? 800-642-1234. Our conversation continues on The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Bishop Robert Morlino, who passed away on Saturday, led the Madison Diocese for 15 years. Working in a liberal part of the state, Morlino was known for his conservatism on political and doctrinal issues, including his views of the ongoing child sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church. We reflect on Bishop Morlino's legacy, how he stood in relation to his contemporaries, and what his successor could mean for Catholicism in Wisconsin. wondering what you think about the passing of Bishop Morlino and what you are looking for in whoever is assigned this post next. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Father Stephen Avella is a Catholic priest and professor of history at Marquette University. He's with us to talk about this morning. Father Avella, some have used the term complicated to describe Bishop Morlino's legacy. He took some strong stances on the social issues of the day. How would you categorize his legacy?
Well, that's a perfect word. Complicated, complex, nuanced. Many of the things that are reported in the press, for example, his attitudes on homosexuality, his opposition to pro-choice politicians, some of his ecclesiastical reforms. He was a great devotee of the Latin Mass, which is now a feature of the life of a number of American Catholics. This experienced a big comeback with him. He did a lot of good, I hope, in bringing a lot of young men to serve as priests. This is one of the big crises of the church here in the U.S. is the shortage of priests worldwide, at least in some parts of the world. And recruiting young men to consider the priesthood, to discern a call to the priesthood, to go to school to study to be priests. He was quite successful in that. That's really kind of an enviable position to have. I read one commentator about him that his bark was worse than his bite, that he could sometimes be quite strident and quite, and make decisions that seemed unfair or unjust. But when you talk to him, when you got one-on-one with him, things were easily smoothed out, and his ideas and his intentions could become clearly, and they were not bad. He was trying to do the best he could in a situation. Being a bishop is a hell of a job. I don't know anybody in their right mind who would want it, because like any leadership position, you're going to win friends and you're going to win enemies. And Bishop Morlino did that. Now, again, he's a bit more sharp-etched in some of his positions and some of the things that he said and did. But that will go with the turf with whoever comes in after him. Whoever comes in, some are going to love him, some are not going to like him. Most are going to say, well, whatever, it doesn't really affect me in any meaningful way.
For those who are not part of the Catholic Church, what is the job of the bishop?
Well, first of all, he's kind of the leader, the spiritual leader of a territorial jurisdiction called a diocese. And he's the chief person in command. It is his responsibility to tend to the spiritual needs of his people. He does this through priests, through religious programs, through deacons, through others who have served the church. But he that's his primary job. We want to make sure that everybody has access to the Mass every Sunday. We want to make sure that people have access to confession, to the sacraments, to the channels of life that are important to us as Catholics. And we also want to make sure that they hear sound teaching, that their moral and ethical life is informed by the gospel, by the teachings of Jesus Christ and the tradition of the Catholic Church. So that's his primary task. Other things are added on. Of course, he's something of a CEO. Ultimate responsibility for finances come to him. Building, personnel decisions, administration of property. He's the official go-between between the church and civic officials, mayors, governors, others. He's kind of the touchstone person. And then he presides at ceremonies, not just religious ceremonies, but dedicatory ceremonies and other things that require the public visibility of the church. So it's a very demanding task. The men who take it are on the road a great bit, a great deal. They have to be good listening people. They have to listen to people very well. And they have to have a lot of stamina and a lot of energy. And they've got to have good health, which unfortunately poor Bishop Morlino
didn't seem to have there at the end. Must have been very exhausting for him.
We had a caller, Janice from New Berlin, who couldn't stay with us, but she called in to say that she hopes the next bishop will be more in line with Vatican II. Bishop Morlino stunted the growth of many Catholics in his community. That was Janice's comment. Father Avella, can you address that comment? And how tough a task does the next bishop face in balancing the traditions of Catholicism with changes in the modern world?
Well, yeah, that in effect is the mission of the Church, to make the gospel alive in every generation, to use the idiom, the language, the vocabulary of every time to proclaim the gospel of Christ. And that's really been one of the hallmarks of Catholic Church history. Sometimes it succeeded, sometimes it hasn't. We have a checkered history. With regards to Vatican II, if I could channel the late bishop, he'd probably say, no, I believed in the council. He's a product of the council. He came to intellectual maturity in the wake of Vatican II. He understood it. He understood its interpretation. And he would say, I interpret Vatican II one way, and I'm not in disobedience to the Vatican II. But others, with equally goodwill and with equal erudition and grasp of what the council stood for, would say, no, there's some things you did that really didn't advance the intent, the letter, or the spirit of Vatican Council II. This is a larger issue in the Church because there continue to be opposing interpretations of Vatican II that exist, particularly here in the American Church, but also in the European Church. The vision of Vatican II was enunciated by Pope John the 23rd, Pope St. John the 23rd, in his opening address, where he called not for new doctrines, not for new rules and regulations, but he said new ways of expressing the timeless truths of Christ, that the moment that he was saying this, the early 60s, was a time that was important for people to hear the message of Christ in a language and in a way they understood. He also called for reform of antiquated structures, and perhaps that's where the criticism of the New Berlin call, because Bishop Morlino seemed to readopt some of the old liturgical customs of yesteryear. I remember, I'm about the same age as Bishop Morlino, just a few years younger, and I remember that old Latin Mass, and very beautiful, very wonderful, but the transition to a new liturgy, which is where most Catholics meet the Church at the Sunday Mass, was really a profound and marvelous change, and many people's lives were truly transformed by it. And so to see going back to the Latin Mass as a positive good upset some of them. Again, I can see both sides. I can see the beauty, the appeal of the Latin Mass, particularly to some young people, not all. But I also, having been a priest for nearly 40 years, see what the power of the renewed, the transformed, the changed liturgy has done in the lives of people. And the council's direction there, to me, is quite clear.
What would be your best piece of advice for the next bishop who serves this diocese?
Go visit all the priests and the deacons. Hold listening sessions with people and listen to them, especially if they want to vent some anger or anxiety. Be aware of the anxiety. Bishop Morlino was very much loved by certain elements of the Diocese of Madison. I would say particularly some priests and almost all his seminarians. He was very good to them. They were very loyal to him. I think approaching them with love and understanding and trying to understand where they come from and what they want to say is very important. And then once you've listened, then take the steps to heal where wounds have been inflicted, to challenge where you think things need to go in certain areas. And then, you know, like most, the advice to most pastors when they take over a new parish, and forgive this if it, I don't mean it to offend, but a new pastor is told to change nothing but his underwear in the first couple of years that he's in a new parish. I would think roughly the same advice would apply to whoever Bishop Morlino's successor is.
Piano, piano, the Italians say. Slow down, slow down. Listen. Take the method. Learn the history of the diocese. It didn't start when you got there. And try to seek out people who are responsible, reliable people who have credible voices that can speak about the experience of Madison's Catholics. And then go forward. You've got to make decisions. You've got to keep the church going forward. You've got to put your mark on it, because it's your turn now to be in that bishop's chair.
Father Stephen Avella is a Catholic priest and professor of history at Marquette University. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, we talk about prison labor. Some people are calling it a modern form of legalized slavery. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution outlawed slavery, but some are calling prison labor a modern form of the institution sanctioned by the amendment's exception for prison labor. Prisoners are helping fight California's wildfires for $1 an hour. Elsewhere, prisoners are leased to private companies as cheap labor. Some are calling this system modern-day slavery. A sociologist joins us to talk about the history of prison labor in America, how programs vary across the country, and who they really benefit, states or inmates. We also take a look at Wisconsin's program. Inmates in California getting paid $1 an hour to fight fires in addition to a time off their sentence. Do you think that's enough money for it to matter? Or do you think the state is taking advantage of cheap labor? Should prisons do away with inmate labor altogether? Why or why not? Employers, do you currently employ inmates? When did you start offering them employment and why? And how much do you pay them? Or maybe you're someone who took advantage of a work program while in prison. What was that like? Did the skills you gained in the program translate to a career outside of prison? Tell us about that as well. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. John Eason is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is the author of Big House on the Prairie, Rise of the Rural Ghetto and Prison Proliferation. John Eason, welcome to The Morning Show.
Thank you, John. It's great to be back again.
Some of the people currently fighting California's wildfires are inmates. The state's Department of Corrections says they're part of a volunteer firefighting program that pays them up to $2 a day and $2 a day when fighting active fires, $1 an hour elsewhere. Some have called this slave labor, but the State Department of Corrections says it helps inmates build skills in firefighting. Johnny said, how do you look at it?
My colleague Phil Goodman at University of Toronto has published a paper where he's looking at prisoners as either heroes or inmates, and he concludes that they're basically both. This isn't just about exploitation, but given the history of exploitation with prison labor, I could see how everyone wants to call this exploitative, and like the convict leasing system or like slavery. There are instances in this country, modern instances, where it harkens back to convict leasing, but it still isn't prison labor still isn't as bad as it was at that point during slavery or convict leasing.
And these inmates in California who have been fighting the wildfires, can they turn their experience into a job as a firefighter once their sentence is completed?
That's been difficult. That doesn't always translate very well. But people want to look at the end result only, as if when people get out, if they can definitely get a job as a firefighter. But it's also about making meaning and sense of your life while you're doing time. I think firefighting is something, people look at it as a heroic job, like you're an individual out there battling flames, but it actually requires a lot of teamwork, coordination, and effort. And I think those skills are transferable in the other jobs as well. You have to realize that many prisoners have been deemed or actually have antisocial behavior. So in prison is not the best environment to socialize people to operate out in society. So if you can give them a task to do, even if you're paying them a nominal fee for their time, I think the experience, at least the way it's been written about and portrayed, Brett's story she's a filmmaker. She had a film that a documentary on PBS that shows firefighters as well, how they make meaning of their lives. Inmates who fight fires, how they make meaning of their life and how it really gives them a sense of purpose.
Who gets the most out of this transaction, the state or the inmate?
It depends on what you're talking about. Monetarily, most definitely the state. Making $1 an hour or $2 an hour is not something that's great for anyone, no matter what condition. Technically, it's not free labor because they're giving them some nominal fee. But I think it's also, this is why I pointed to how the inmates make sense of what they're doing. They're not doing this. There is some agency by the inmates. They could just choose to do other prison labor, or they could choose not to do this type of work at all. Given their options, this is actually a real privilege. So I think in that sense, it's a win-win. It's not like in Angola, which is a prison in Louisiana, which was converted from slavery a slave plantation straight into a prison, where prisoners do menial labor for pennies on the dollar, and basically work until they die because many of them are on death row. If you contrast what's going on with prison labor in California versus a place like Louisiana, you have to see a real benefit for the inmates, but the state is always winning in these exchanges.
John Eason is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We're talking about the prison labor system in America. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Let's take a call. Ann is with us in Green Bay. Ann, good morning.
Good morning. Well, I'm all for the prisoners being able to do work. I think it gives them something to do, and some of them can gain some skills. But they need to be paid a living wage or a wage that everyone else that would be doing that job, because when you're in prison, you still have to pay for phone calls and items from the canteen and certain amount of clothing and some of your dental and medical care. So they still have to pay for things in prison. So they should be paid a wage in which they can afford to do these things.
And thanks for that call. Let's take a call from Bill in Superior and get another take on this same issue, and then we'll have our guest respond. Bill, go ahead.
Yeah, I completely disagree with that. They are criminals. They broke the law. Why are they getting paid at all is where I'm going with it. There shouldn't be like an ongoing restitution for they're getting food for free, they're getting education for free, they're getting health care for free, on top of them being incarcerated. Why are they getting paid for doing bad things? I completely disagree with your former caller.
Okay, well, we have two contrasting callers there, Ann and Bill. John Eason, care to respond to those?
I want to thank both callers for their opinions. The issue is very complicated. While Ann, I can see the need for advocating for higher wages given the cost associated with being a prisoner, there are some limits to that. And the other caller, I think that's more of the tough on crime. I don't think people are getting paid for doing bad things if they're already in prison. So we can either decide to put good money into investing in actually rehabilitating people, or we can continue to throw money away. Prisoners typically aren't getting free education. Much of our educational programs throughout the country have been stripped out of prisons. So people can't go into prison and get a GED or other definitely not higher ed degrees. Those have been cut back in many states, especially in the South. So in healthcare in prison, while there is, they have access to healthcare, it's not the best healthcare. That's very complicated. And given the fact that prisoners, we also have debtors prisoners today, you have to realize that. There are people who are convicted of not paying a fine who have been put into prison because they couldn't afford to pay a fine they got. So punishing them further by not allowing them to work or not giving them any way to earn their way out of a situation doesn't help. So that's my response to that.
All right. Thanks for those calls. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. John, let's briefly talk a little bit about the history of prison labor in America. The 13th Amendment ended slavery but left open a loophole. How does that work?
So 1865 were the final slaves were set free in Texas. They were 2.5 years late with that. But in 1867, convict leasing started picking up across the South. And convict leasing is where people who were incarcerated were forced into work camps. So there were white people in these work camps as well, but it was disproportionately young black men, as young as 14. So thousands of young black men across the South were forced into these labor camps, doing mining, forestry, and the like, and states leased them out to private companies and took all of the money. They didn't even reinvest into the camps. So they basically worked these young men to death. And since the late 1800s, the disproportionate rate of incarceration for African-American men that still exists today was established. And it was established around prison labor. So the worry about prison labor hearkening back to slavery is real, but we don't have that. We don't have those same conditions where people are being worked to death in camps today.
We'll continue our conversation with John Eason, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, in a moment. We're talking about the prison labor system. You can join us at 800-642-1234. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Prison labor in America, that's what's on our mind this hour. Some are calling it modern-day slavery. Others are saying it's a great way to rehabilitate people who are in prison and give them some skills that they can use when they get out. John Eason is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the author of Big House on the Prairie, Rise of the Rural Ghetto, and Prison Proliferation. John Eason, let's fast forward to the modern day. Prisons in all states, do they put their inmates to work in some capacity?
Many states do. There's a historic prison industries that's it's national, but it's run by individual states. So many of them do. It's a way to keep them active. Prison industries, when we were going through the tough on crime era, actually suffered a lot, fiscally conservative politicians cut funding for it, saying that prisoners didn't even deserve to work, really. So the tough on crime move against prison work, where education was cut in prisons. So it's gone through some different phases, and we actually have it here in Wisconsin. The Badger State Industries is a big part of building furniture and doing other things, for state entities. So professors, for example, I just moved here a few months ago. One of the places I could get furniture from for my office was from Badger State Industries. So, yeah, states have this. It's been around for, I think, since 1915.
How does prison labor vary from state to state? Is it used for punitive purposes in some states or rehabilitative reasons in others?
I don't think it's used for punitive. It's not used for punishment as much, even in Angola, which is one of the worst examples. But there are rather mundane jobs where you're just like pressing license plates. You're not going to have many skills, transferable skills from that. There are call centers in prisons now. There used to be call centers overseas. We've moved some of those into prisons. So there are different types of jobs that you can get in prison, in prisons, but it varies from state to state. But I'd have to say the South, if a place is going to be more punitive, it's going to be in the South.
Let's take a call from Lucy in Madison next. Lucy, good morning.
Good morning. I originally called in because I wanted to tell you that I know a young man in prison who's working for the state at a very low wage, and he should be getting out soon, and so he's really hoping he can get a better job in order to have enough money not to be destitute when he gets out. And that's a problem. A lot of prisoners get out with nothing, and that really makes it hard for them not to reoffend because of the draconian nature of the parole rules. But the other thing that I heard as you're talking is about the Jim Crow system of imprisoning black people so that they could work, and I think there's a lot more to it than what you've said. There's a great a documentary that you can stream for free from PBS called Slavery by Another Name, and one thing that it points out was that the laws were specifically made to be able to imprison black people, like vagrancy laws that said if you don't have a job, you're violating the law, so we can imprison you. And I think even today we see some repetition of that, or some remainder of that, in some of the things that are going on, like in the area of Ferguson, Missouri. That in that whole area, there are a lot of municipalities that have a rule that you can't have a guest in your home unless you register them with the police department.
Okay, Lucy, a lot to chew on there in a limited amount of time. John Eason, care to comment on what Lucy had to say?
I think Slavery by Another Name is a great documentary, and I was remiss in mentioning it. But yes, it is a great documentary, and it can give a lot more detail. I didn't think we had time to give the whole history of prison industries, prison labor, justice, but I would definitely check that out. As far as the remnants of Jim Crow laws, yes, there are remnants of these laws. You can see pants sagging laws pop up all across the country. There are a number of these, you couldn't spit on the street during Jim Crow. African Americans couldn't spit on the street and other minor laws, but it's also the enforcement of these laws. It's not just the existence, it's the enforcement of these laws. So that goes into policing, which is, if we're talking about prison labor, that's several steps removed. And I'm not trying to minimize racism today. Racism has been prevalent in this country since the founding. So it's just taken another form. And you can't talk about slavery and Jim Crow and mass incarceration all as sort of one thing. They're very mm-hmm. different systems. So,
Lucy, thanks for sharing your story with us. Let's go to Jake in Milwaukee next. Jake, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Professor. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, go ahead.
So I wanted to hear Professor Eastman's comments on the potential complications of private prison systems who have contracts with the state and can actually draw a penalty fine from the state if their numbers get too low, and how that may play into the labor system, as well as how the invisible penalty in many states where if you go to prison, especially for a felony, even when you get out, there are many jobs you are not able to have because you cannot get the licenses for it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Jake, we need to give John Eason time to respond to your questions here. Go ahead.
Jake, those were two great questions. First, the private prison industry, if you want to look at the exploitation of that industry as it relates to the criminal justice system, you really need to look at the immigrant detention system, where 55% of the immigrant detention centers are owned or operated by private industries. Only 10% of prisons are operated by private industries. So that's not as big a problem as people make it seem. There are some examples of exploitation, but they're kind of overblown. The worst stuff being done in prison labor is through states, not so much through private industries. And secondly, if we're talking about prisoners when they get out and their job opportunities, we actually we probably do need to invest more in prison industries within the prison, but there needs to be more money put on the outside of prisons. And when people are reentering society, there's two million people incarcerated, 2.2 million people incarcerated annually. There's over there's normally 8 to 10 million who are on probation and parole who need help getting a job. So that's where we need to put more money.
Briefly, when we think about prison reform, does prison labor fit into the picture, and if so, how?
It does fit into the picture, and I think it needs to be linked where there's continuity between potential positions, not a one-to-one match, a perfect match. So if you're a firefighter in prison, you get out and you're being trained to be a firefighter on the other side. But if you're a firefighter or had any other one or more regular jobs like building furniture, which they do in Wisconsin, that you can be matched up with a series of other employment programs upon your release. So there needs to be more and better connections to industries established outside of prisons, and there needs to be ways for people to leave prison and go into those jobs.
John Eason is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and author of Big House on the Prairie, Rise of the Rural Ghetto, and Prison Proliferation. John, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, John.
I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.